This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, Sir Ken Robinson on transforming our nation's schools. And in Focus on Technology, pinpointing the perfect strains of medical marijuana through technology. Starting us off this afternoon, if you never learned it in school or you just don't remember it, how the land boundaries of Ohio were decided as it became a state is a fascinating story. Much of the area we now know as Ohio was once owned by Virginia, Connecticut, and several high-profile private owners, including George Washington. Joining us to explore how Ohio came to be and the influence the state's early history has had on Ohio are Dr. Matthew Sauer, Associate Professor at the University of Cincinnati, McMicken College of Arts and Sciences, Dr. William Russell Coyle, writer and adjunct lecturer at The Ohio State University, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. And good to have you all on the show today.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
So, William, what was the area known as the Ohio Country? What was that like throughout the 1600s and the 1700s? There were quite a few influences going on, and the area was actually a lot bigger than what we know as present-day Ohio, wasn't it?
Sure. It's often called by Europeans the Ohio Country, meaning the Ohio River watershed. So trace your finger on a map along the Ohio River, and that's what people would have considered the Ohio Country. As to the place, from 1600 to the 1800s, a series of very profound demographic, technological, and economic changes wiped right through the entire region. So it's hard to speak of the Ohio Country from 1600 to 1800 as any one thing because it changed so profoundly so often.
I think one of the greatest things to know is that the Ohio Country was always in conflict. The Iroquois nation needing European trade goods to maintain their own political agenda, depopulated parts of the Ohio Country in order to maintain the fur business for themselves. So this is a area of contention not only between the Europeans, the French and the English, but also as Ohio's first peoples compete in that arena as well.
And the French and Indian War, which was settled by the Treaty of Paris in 1863, what did that do in terms of shaping what would come next
You have two things.
Yeah.
There's a whole series of land grants,
right,
which George Washington and a number of other very prominent Virginia families will take up land that's granted to them for their service in the French and Indian War, but it also removes the French from the Ohio Valley, which places the Native Americans at a disadvantage.
Right.
They had used the French as a lever between themselves and the people they feared the most, which were the Virginians. And so they had the British, the French, the Virginians. Now with the French gone, you have, you know, Pontiac's Rebellion, an attempt to kind of resettle it. And then you have the British. Actually, the Ohio Country becomes a flashpoint for the Revolution because the British begin to try to use the Native Americans as a way to buffer the expansion of the colonies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could add to that perhaps that it forces Native Americans in the Ohio Country and the Great Lakes to adapt their methods of staving off white encroachment instead of playing the British off the French and the English colonists off the British back in England. They had to try new methods, and one of those new methods was Tecumseh and his attempt to build an Indian nation, built on the concept of an Indian race. In fact, what he was doing was trying to imitate George Washington in some respects.
And Tecumseh traveled far, far from Ohio in order to try to do that.
Correct. Yeah, all up and down the Ohio Valley. Towards the Mississippi, recruiting people to join this new, really new kind of idea that Indians could form one nation and consider themselves one race. It was really kind of a radical idea that Tecumseh introduced.
William and Matt, any thought on how things might have turned out differently if the French had won the French and Indian War?
Well, the French have a very different sense of colonial development. The British come in. the colonists come in to possess the land, which is to take it and to improve it, which is the French don't have that surplus population. And so they're interested in partnering with the First Peoples to exploit the resources. So their pattern of exploitation is very different. So the pattern of settlement is going to be different. Even if you look at Upper Canada, which is French Canada, they never had the kind of surplus population that you see in the English colonies.
Mm-hmm. And I like to think of, when I teach my students about this subject, I like to talk about a series of moments where one thing or another might have changed very, very radically what happened to Native Americans in Ohio. And even on up through the War of 1812, there's still a possibility that, however slim, that Native Americans could have retained some control and influence in this place. And one of the British generals early on in that war in Canada, General Brock, is very open to Tecumseh's methods, Tecumseh's goals, but Brock is killed. And after that moment, there really is no British general who's willing to pay attention, if you will, to what the Indians might need. And so a different set of values, a different set of goals come into play, and the Indian interests are sort of tossed aside.
One of the things I wanted to talk about was the establishment of the Virginia Military District, which I think was very, very significant in the development of what Ohio is even today, and also the Connecticut influence in the Western Reserve and the Firelands, where you had almost, you know, these two.
Well, you have two different cultures.
Two different cultures.
So they always, some people have always said that the Mason-Dixon line runs through Columbus.
Right.
And so
exactly.
And so if you, the southern half of the state is heavily influenced by Virginia and Pennsylvania, but a lot of Virginia, the bounty lands for Virginian Revolutionary War veterans drew a lot into that area. The northern part of the state is from Connecticut, the Connecticut Reserve, and so you have a very different mm-hmm. civilization. So if you look at Kirkland and other places, they really remind you of New England. Marietta right. is a New England town, mm-hmm. so you have a piece of that in southern Ohio. But the primary culture is Virginian, and so the.
But it was that area between the Little Miami and the Scioto River right. that basically was the Virginia Military.
Right. And lands. And they'll hand out lands until 1875 when they turn the lands over.
Right.
What's left.
And that went to various Revolutionary right. War figures.
And George Washington never picked up his. He had 23,000 acres that he was eligible for. He didn't. He had some lands in Belmont County. Mm-hmm. He had land patents in Hamilton County. He had land patents in Claremont County. At one point, I think the figure I saw in Pennsylvania, Virginia, he had a total of about 94 square miles of land. So he wasn't a speculator. There's a difference between George Washington sort of saw as a developer. He wanted to go in, attract people. He actually went to visit his land. He wasn't buying land to sell it quick, cheap. So he's not a speculator in that sense.
Mm-hmm. But the Firelands.
Go ahead,
Doc.
Well, I was just going to note that the Virginia Military District, because it's largely settled by Southerners, it very much looks like a southern Kentucky county just picked up and moved to Ohio. Mm-hmm. It takes on characteristics of the South. In particular, in that first half of the 19th century, the Scioto Valley is defined by economic inequality. In 1850, about 100 men owned two-thirds of the land. And you have these large farms, very often cattle farms, interspersed with small towns, sort of classic Virginia-Kentucky configuration. And early on, to the extent that there were African Americans in Ohio, they at first centered in the Scioto Valley. So it takes on the economic and political characteristics, the economic characteristics of the places where these migrants came from.
You know, I've lived in both parts of Ohio, the old Virginia Military District, and in the Firelands, or the old Connecticut part. I mean, these are two very different cultures, even today. Tell us a little bit about Connecticut's, you know, how Connecticut got a grasp on.
Well, you have two pieces. Well, Connecticut, that
the
land.
Western Reserve.
Well, that land is part of their colonial charter that goes from sea to sea.
Right.
There's a piece of it you call Firelands, which are territories granted to the sufferers, people who their towns had been burned out by during the Revolutionary War. Benedict Arnold had personally burned New London, Connecticut. They were granted land in the reserve as a compensation. Their heirs and their widows were granted compensation. Ultimately, Connecticut will dispose what's left of their lands will dispose them to Ohio. But what's interesting about the Western Reserve is again there's a very purposeful plan of settlement, and you see the same thing in the Seven Ranges. You see the same thing in other parts, where again we're trying to avoid the mess that happened in Kentucky. That they want this to be an orderly transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I lived in Huron County for some time, and you look at the map of Huron County, and there is a New London, and there is a Norwalk, and there is a Fairfield, and almost every village township is named after a Connecticut place.
And that, go ahead, William.
I was just going to build off Dr. Sauer's point that. A community like Marietta and the Ohio Company, it very much was a planned community, down even to the kind of trees that you could possibly plant along the sidewalk. So it was designed to bring an orderly process to what they considered was an untamed wilderness. But I think one of the important points of early Ohio history is that settlement here, development here is chaotic and messy despite the best efforts of people east of the Appalachians. I mean, ideally, Marietta is the model going forward.
And
realistically, Cincinnati is the model that wins out.
Absolutely. It doesn't work out. Mm-hmm. And people forget that, you know, the first they were just celebrating the Ohio's bicentennial farms. The first farm that's still in the same family was granted in 1772. It's in Adams County. So there's settlement that goes – Mm-hmm. That goes back, and it is a chaotic – when they came to the Ohio River, when they're going to set up the grant, they had to ward off thousands of people that had already moved in. You know, they had to actually move them out, and so it is a messy process.
William, we're talking about how there are cultural differences between the northern part of the state and the southern part of the state because of Connecticut and Virginia's influences. Are a lot of those differences still in existence today that you can see?
Well, I think the state has changed so much so radically that those traditional differences really don't mean as much. Specifically, the wave of industrialization in the late 19th and early 20th century began bringing a new wave of Appalachians and deep Southerners into Ohio, and they didn't live in places like what we would call the Virginia Military District or the Connecticut Reserve, right? They went to cities. They went to Columbus. They went to Akron. They went to Middletown, Ohio, in the Miami Valley, to work in factories. And so they flocked to cities, to urban industrial life. And so, you know, Columbus, Ohio can boast as a favorite son Dwight Yoakam today, the country music star, whose family moved from central Kentucky up Route 23 all the way to central Ohio for work in the Buckeye Steel Factory. So I think industrialization, new patterns of migration has diminished the importance of those older traditional 19th century patterns.
I think the only echo that I might see is in our race relations. It's often been said that southern Ohio is the southernmost echo of race relations. Northern Ohio still has an image, a different image of race relations. And so I think it's a very faint echo, but I think you can still see it in those social relationships.
Yeah. You know, perhaps Cincinnati has, long had race riots throughout the 19th century and racial difficulties in the 20th century. But so was Cleveland. So was Youngstown. And, I think part of the problem, again, is that people have scattered themselves about in new ways, in new places. And so it's kind of difficult to see those 19th century patterns replicating themselves over and over.
We're talking about the historical influences on Ohio with Dr. Matthew Sauer, associate professor at the University of Cincinnati McMicken College of Arts and Sciences, Dr. William Russell Coyle, writer and adjunct lecturer at The Ohio State University, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. And Matt, so at one point you have Connecticut, you have New York, you have Virginia, you even have Pennsylvania, I think, that's into this whole mix of what Ohio is at that time. How does all this mesh together and how is all this resolved?
Well, Ohio plays the same game as the states in the East. Federalists are strong in Cincinnati, Marietta, and you have Chillicothe, which becomes a sort of a base for Jeffersonianism. And you, in the early period, you have this contest between those ideas. Arthur Sinclair, the territorial governor, is very much a Federalist. Thomas Worthington is a Jeffersonian. And so you have – so I think in the first early period, we really are playing out these national issues about the nature of democracy and the nature of governance. And the first Ohio Constitution is really a very Jeffersonian document. So you get a sense of who wins out. It is going to be the sort of chaotic sort of Virginian, Pennsylvanian. It's not going to be the betters of society which are going to set this up. At least that's the ideal.
Yeah, I think pursuant to that exactly is that the governor in that first constitution, the governor's office is quite weak. Power resides in the legislature, the popular will of the people. And there was a great suspicion, for example, of appointed judges. Just who are these elites trying to tell us how to live our lives and what to do? So judges very early on were often a target of popular discontent.
And Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, played a big role in actually surveying the land, didn't he? I mean, he came up with some ideas, and it was a fairly new concept at the time. That was something he promoted, right?
Well, the Northwest Ordinances, I think, are one of the chief fruits of the Confederation period, in that Jefferson's notion and the people around him, his notion is that these territories were going to be organized as states with all the rights and privileges of the original states. They weren't going to be colonies. And this is a new thing. This is a new political understanding that you could hand over these ancient political rights to new entities. So yeah, Jefferson did have a lot to play in that.
And the creation of the Northwest Territory, I mean, basically set up the steps towards statehood for places like Ohio.
And that really stays the basis of our territorial system going west.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some modifications and changes over time, but
– but that was a model.
That was the model. And it was groundbreaking at the time. And the same thing with outlawing slavery.
Mm-hmm.
There's already slavery in the Illinois country, but they outlaw slavery, which is a huge, huge step.
This point is essential. Earlier I said that one of the words that characterizes Ohio settlement is messy. A second one is experimental. The national government willingly embraced new methods to try to figure out how to control this particular area. And through the public land survey system, it is dividing up the land into these townships. No one had ever done that before. So experimental is a good word to apply to this early statehood.
Matt, what were some of the challenges faced by these early surveyors, and how long did that whole process take?
The surveying the seven ranges was very, very difficult. I mean, transportation, I mean, there isn't any. I mean, you have some basic trails, but there is – so you're over heel and over deal trying to square these out. And they also had to invent – create a system for keeping them square. I mean, so you had to sort of invent how you're going to measure these out. You have all the problems of not only the landscape, but also the native animals in the landscape. But you also have suspicious Native Americans thinking, you know, we have a sense of why you're here, because this happened in Pennsylvania, this happened in Delaware. And so this is a – so there's all kinds of challenges to this. But it's also interesting that, you know, the surveyors are some of the people who get rich. So this is like George Washington being a surveyor. I mean, mm-hmm. you're the surveyor. You get paid some of the land that you survey. And so guess what pieces of land you decide to take as your payment. So there's a need to go out and do it.
And maybe 2 points to add to that. The initial surveyors, people like Christopher Gist in the mid-1700s, they had to hide their surveying equipment from Indians because Indians knew understood right away what that meant. The second point is about the difficulties of surveying Ohio. Consider where they started. The Seven Ranges in the southeastern part of the state, which is all full of hills and forests and rocks and creeks and everything imaginable that could make a surveyor's job difficult to do.
William, was there a specific point in time when it becomes clear that Ohio is going to be organized as a single state and something that triggered that?
Well, Jefferson's idea in the mid-1780s is to have several states. And you can Google his map and see the different names of the states that he had. But I think for me an important turning point is the Battle of Fallen Timbers in the 1790s. And that's really the last violent resistance that Native Americans offer in this place that we now call Ohio. I think at that point it's clear that it's going to be an American state controlled by the United States, settled by the United States.
I think that's absolutely true, absolutely critical. You can see the growth of Cincinnati after 1794 is really significant. Mm-hmm. People feel secure in moving into the area. But I also think that Jefferson needed or wanted Ohio's votes and Ohio's electoral votes. And so they're going to split this off. They're going to make the Indiana territory, and they're going to make sure that Ohio moves with some expediency to statehood. And
that's an excellent point, and that's why the Jeffersonian Republicans in Ohio, people like Thomas Worthington and his brother-in-law Edward Tiffin and Nathaniel Massey, these Scioto Valley bigwigs, if you will, are pressing faster against Arthur St. Clair, the Federalist governor of the territory. Let's get this to be a state before the election of 1804, when Jefferson is up for re-election.
William, what was the exact date that Ohio becomes a state?
1803.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until a lot later, though, was it?
It's 1953 when they.
Why is that?
When they, I mean, they, yeah,
right.
That's, see, that's a trick question. That's a trick question. They forgot to file the paperwork.
That's right.
But nonetheless, we get credit for being the 17th state then or the Union.
Well, Matthew, William, and Howard, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Matthew Sauer, Associate Professor at the University of Cincinnati McMicken College of Arts and Sciences, Dr. William Russell Coyle, Writer and Adjunct Lecturer at The Ohio State University, and WVXU Political Reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can find links at the WVXU website to places that you can learn more about the formation of Ohio. Coming up, Sir Ken Robinson's ideas for creative schools, later in Focus on Technology, using technology to pinpoint the perfect strains of medical marijuana. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.